Welcome once again to our program, Salvation History, the New Testament, the story of the redemption and liberation of all humankind. I'm your host today, Monsignor Larry Moran, chaplain of the Carmelite Monastery in John Paul II Catholic High in Terre Haute. Our guest, again, is who has been through all this series, Ron Eldred, who teaches religion and history at John Paul II Catholic High. And we've been, in our last session, talking about the birth of Jesus as recounted in the New Testament. Today we're up to the Epiphany of our Lord, the coming of the manifestation of Jesus to the Gentile world. So Ron, once again, welcome back to the series and the program, which you put so much resource and study into. What can we say? Isn't it true that after the presentation and the purification of the child Mary and the child Jesus in the temple, the Holy Family returned to Bethlehem rather than going back to Nazareth?
Yes, that's right. The Bible is silent why they settled there rather than returning to Nazareth. Perhaps Joseph and Mary decided to stay in Bethlehem because it was only about 7 miles away from Jerusalem, a little bit to the south from Jerusalem and the temple, his father's house. Tradition has it that they lived in Bethlehem before moving to Nazareth, but that's just a tradition which there's no way to prove it one way or the other. And by this time, that is 40 days after Jesus' birth, Joseph would have moved the family into a house and begun to trade his trade as a carpenter. Luke doesn't tell us about the events that followed, so we have to go to the Gospel of Matthew to continue this story.
Okay, well, Matthew continues the story with the famous coming of the Magi, or the wise men from the East. What can you tell us about that?
Well, we'll quote from Matthew because he tells it best. Now, when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the East came to Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the East and have come to worship him." When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him, and assembled all the chief priests and scribes of the people. He inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. They told him, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for so it is written by the prophet, 'And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who will govern my people Israel.'" That's in Matthew 2:1-6. And of course, Micah is the prophet's spoken of here, references to Micah 5:2-14. Well, of course, Herod was very disturbed by this news because he was extremely jealous of his power and was suspicious of anyone, of everyone, including his own wife and sons. In fact, he had killed his beloved wife, Mariamne, and three of his sons because he was suspicious of their intent. They probably were intended to do something to him. But one of his sons was strangled along with 300 others at Jericho when a plot was uncovered to depose him. Now, St. Matthew continues the story saying, quote, "Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem saying, 'Go and search diligently for the child. When you have found him, bring me word, that I too may come and worship him.' When they heard the king, they went their way. And lo, the star, which they had seen in the east, went before them, till it came to rest over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. Then opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way." This is found in Matthew 2:1-12.
Ron, how about all through Christian history, these gifts have kind of taken on symbolic meaning. And, of course, we're not even sure there weren't more magi, but because of the three gifts, the guess is that there were three. What is the Christian tradition said about the meaning of these gold, frankincense, and myrrh given to Jesus?
Well, the gold symbolizes the kingship of Jesus, the frankincense his divinity, and the myrrh his death. Gold in the ancient world was almost always a monopoly of royalty. Incense was used to send pleasing odors to worship God or the gods, because it was used by the pagans as well in their religions. And myrrh is a valuable aromatic substance taken from a special tree and was used to prepare the dead for burial.
Okay, who actually were the magi that the scriptures speak about?
Well, there's been a lot of speculation over the centuries about whom these men were and from where they came. One hypothesis has it that they came from Persia, which would be, of course, present-day Iran, because they are called magi. In some places, they are called wise men or kings. And if they were, in fact, magi, they would have been astrologers from a priestly class of the Zoroastrian religion in Persia. And astrology is a pseudoscience that holds that the heavens control events here on Earth, and that the positions of the stars and planets in the heavens influence human affairs and terrestrial events. Before and during the Babylonian captivity, which we talked about in some detail in our series on the Old Testament, Jews had lived in the region, and as a result, it's likely that an educated class of priest, a pagan priest or Zoroastrian priest, would have been familiar with the Hebrew scriptures that contained prophecies about the Messiah. Others have speculated they might have come from Arabia, where Jewish settlements had been established by a Babylonian king. Well, wherever they came from would have been where Jews had settled as part of the diaspora or the scattering of the Jews. And it's not likely that they were kings, since they were astrologers who studied the stars to foretell the future. Kings would have employed them to divine the future for them before they made any major decisions. But this in itself would have made them very wealthy and a very powerful caste. Whoever they were, they certainly were men of prominence and traveled with an entourage large enough to attract Herod's attention when they came into his kingdom.
Okay, what about legend has given names? It seems like Christian imagination never wants to talk about a person without giving them a name, like Longinus, for the one who put the spear in Jesus' side and the like. So they've given them the name Caspar, Melchior, and Balthasar. Does that mean that there were only three of them that came?
Well, we really don't know how many made the journey to Bethlehem because the Bible does not tell us, but tradition has assumed there were three because of the three gifts mentioned in St. Matthew's Gospel.
Okay, what about the speculation on the subject of the Star of Bethlehem? Was it a natural event to which the Magi place special significance, or do we think it was a miraculous occurrence?
The star that the wise men followed appeared to be the fulfillment of a prophecy of Balaam. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob. A scepter shall rise out of Israel. This is found in Numbers 24:17. If it were a natural event, perhaps the astronomer Johannes Kepler, who lived 1571 to 1630, his hypothesis that the star of Bethlehem was the conjunction of three planets, Jupiter, Saturn, and Mars, and the constellation of Pisces that occurred the winter before that. This phenomenon appears about every 800 years. Or was it the following year when Jupiter and Saturn approached one another, similar to the conjunction of planets we have experienced over the past several years? If you look out in the night sky, you can see that these planets are a lot of times very, very close to one another. Nevertheless, it's quite possible, even probable, that it was a miraculous event directly caused by God's intervention rather than some, you know, natural
phenomenon.
Natural occurrence, yes.
So it could have been either.
It could have been either.
Okay.
I mean, God works these secondary causes a lot more than he intervenes, you know, and sets aside his laws of nature.
But it's still God at work.
It's still God at work.
Well, what about the Catechism of the Catholic Church, to which you've referred so many times, in which we're recommending people go to find out anything official that the Catholic Church is talking about or teaches today? What does the Catechism say about Epiphany, or the coming of the wise men?
It says, I'll quote from the Catechism, quote, "The Epiphany is the manifestation of Jesus as Messiah of Israel, Son of God and Savior of the world. The great feast of Epiphany celebrates the adoration of Jesus by the wise men, the Magi, from the east, together with his baptism in the Jordan and the wedding feast at Cana in Galilee." Those are other cases of manifestation or Epiphany. "In the Magi, I'm back to the Catechism now. In the Magi, representatives of the neighboring pagan religions, the gospel sees the first fruits of the nations who welcome the good news of salvation through the incarnation. The Magi's coming to Jerusalem in order to pay homage to the King of the Jews shows that they seek in Israel, in the messianic light of the Star of David, the one who will be King of the nations. Their coming means that pagans can discover Jesus and worship him as Son of God and Savior of the world only by turning toward the Jews and receiving from them the messianic promise as contained in the Old Testament. The Epiphany shows that the fuller number of the nations now takes its place in the family of the patriarchs and acquires Israelitica, dignitas, that is, two Latin words there, is made worthy of the heritage of Israel." This is found in paragraph number 528.
In the Catechism of the Catholic Church, which we've been quoting so often and so referring it for people's to use it as often as they can. I wanted to ask you, made a comment there. Don't we usually say that the manifestation of Jesus was to the shepherds, to the chosen people, and the manifestation to the Gentiles, the non-chosen people, at Epiphany?
Yes, and we'll get to the shepherds here in just a little bit.
Okay, sorry for jumping ahead. How about the Holy Innocents, which is a story that's very tragic, that's reported to us in the Gospels. To escape the wrath of Herod, the Holy Family left for Egypt, Mary riding on the donkey, as often seen in Christian art. What about the story of the Magi going home and Herod trying to find the Christ child or the newborn King of the Jews?
When the Magi departed for home by another way, rather than returning to Herod first, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Rise, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt, and remain there till I tell you. For Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him." And he rose and took the child and his mother by night and departed to Egypt, remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, "Out of Egypt have I called my son." Then Herod, when he saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, was in a furious rage, and he sent and killed all the male children in Bethlehem and all that region who were 2 years old or under, according to the time which he had ascertained from the wise men. Then was fulfilled what was spoken by the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, wailing and loud lamentation, Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be consoled because they were no more. This is found in Matthew 2:13-18, and Matthew's quoting Jeremiah 31:15. We don't know how old Jesus was at the time of the Magi's visit, but he could have been as old as two. The number of the infants who were the first martyrs for the faith, that is the Holy Innocents, the number probably would have been about 25 to 30, because Bethlehem was just a small village.
when you quoted about Rachel weeping for her children, it reminded me of Rachel's Vineyard today, which helps women who have gone through the trauma of abortion to try and heal themselves by good Catholic principles, and people who have been through abortion helping them to reconcile themselves to the loss of their child. So it's named after what you quoted there, Rachel wailing in loud lamentation, weeping for her children. Well, let's talk about that flight into Egypt. That's a long way to go for a couple with a child. What can we say about that? How difficult would it have been?
The terrain of the Gaza Strip over which they had traveled is among the most formidable in the world. It's a desert area with mountains and valleys and a rough wilderness desert region called the Negev. With Mary and the baby, Jesus riding a donkey and Joseph walking beside them. And they might have hitched up with a caravan. That was very common back in those days because it was very dangerous to travel alone because of robbers and other people, you know, plying that type of a trade. But nonetheless, the family would have traveled about 300-mile distance in about 2 weeks' time. The Bible is silent on where they went in Egypt, but many Jews were left over from before the Exodus, and others subsequently had been exiled from Palestine. They also lived in Egypt, many and most of them probably in the Delta region around Alexandria. Perhaps Joseph plied his trade as a carpenter to earn a living, and don't forget that the Magi had given them what was probably a considerable sum of gold that they could have lived on. The Bible doesn't tell us how long they stayed in Egypt, but it could have been several years, according to some sources. The Catechism says of the flight into Egypt, quote, "The flight into Egypt and the massacre of the innocents make manifest the opposition of darkness to the light. He came to his own home, and his own people received him not. Christ's whole life was lived under the sign of persecution. His own share in it, with Jesus' departure from Egypt, recalls the Exodus. It presents him as the definitive liberator of God's people." This is found in paragraph 350, or 530, I'm sorry. The story of the flight into Egypt is told in Matthew 2:13 through 23.
Okay, so however long they were there, the scriptures talk about them returning back again home to the Holy Land or to Palestine. An angel appears to Joseph in a dream, probably Gabriel, told him it was safe to return home because King Herod had died. What do we say about this episode?
Again, they had to travel along the Mediterranean Sea through some of the most forbidding territory in the world. And apparently they were headed for Bethlehem. But as they approached Judea, the angel again appeared to Joseph in a dream and said not to return there because Herod's wicked son, Archelaus, or Calus, I've heard it pronounced both ways, was reigning, but instead to go back to Nazareth. This is found in Matthew 2:19-23.
Okay, tell us, it's a little confusing about Herod's, because there are several. Tell us about King Herod the Great's successors.
Yes, we've already spent quite a bit of time talking about King Herod the Great in our series on the Old Testament, and a little bit in this series in the earlier part on the New Testament. So now we're a little bit to say about it. He died in 4 BC, it's believed, King Herod the Great. And even before that, he'd already fallen out of favor with the Roman Emperor Kaiser or Caesar Augustus because of his mistreatment of his subjects. The story has it that after he murdered members of his own family, Augustus jokingly said, "I would rather be Herod's pig than Herod's son." Now there was it was said in Greek, so there was a little pun to that, I understand. But moreover, the emperor knew that Herod's heirs were evil as well. Therefore, instead of appointing a king to replace Herod, he appointed one ethnarch and two tetrarchs. The term ethnarch refers to rulers of Roman vassal kingdoms who were less than kings. Herod's three sons were selected for the positions. Archelaus was to rule Judea, Samaria, and Idumea as the ethnarch. So he was kind of the head of the three. And then there was Herod Antipas, another son, who was to rule Galilee and Perea as tetrarch, meaning ruler of a quarter. That's literally what tetrarch meant. And Herod Philip was to rule a third territory northeast of this of the realm as tetrarch. Archelaus was to be the senior ruler, but he was just as evil as his father. And Herod Antipas, he was less evil than his brother, but you have to remember that he was the one who allowed John the Baptist to be beheaded. And then there was Herod Philip. He was the least evil of the three. Archelaus, he had alienated so many of his subjects in a few years by continuing in his father's tyrannical ways that Augustus deposed him and replaced him with a Roman official called a procurator, one of whom was Pontius Pilate. He was the fifth one. These three territories were reunited for a short time under Herod the Great's grandson, Herod Agrippa. I think it was Herod Agrippa the first, from AD 41 to 44, and we'll encounter him again in the Acts of the Apostles.
Okay, could we take a look at the hidden years of Jesus, which are so wrapped in cloaks of mystery that we don't really know very much about them. So what can we say about the hidden years of Jesus?
The several years that follow are known as the hidden years of Jesus' life because the Bible says very little about these years. The 1911 edition of the Catholic Encyclopedia says of this period of Jesus' life, quote, "It was in the seclusion of Nazareth that Jesus spent the greatest part of his earthly life. The inspired records are very reticent about this period." And then it goes on to quote several places here in Luke, Mark, and John proves what they're saying. But they're about the only passages which refer to Jesus' hidden life. Although St. Luke doesn't mention the flight into Egypt, he tells us that after Jesus' presentation of the temple and Mary's purification, which we'll get to, the Holy Family returned to Nazareth in Galilee. And the child grew and became strong, filled with wisdom, and the favor of God was upon him. That's Luke 2:39-40. Hundreds of books have been written over the years describing what Jesus' life must have been like during these years, and some of them are good and some of them are bad. The Catechism states of the hidden years, quote, "Many things about Jesus of interest to human curiosity do not figure in the Gospels. Almost nothing is said about the hidden life of Jesus, and even a great part of his public life is not recounted." That's in paragraph 514. Nonetheless, enough is known about the history of the era and the area at the time that the historians and biographers have been able to reconstruct something of the life of the Holy Family during these years. And of the obscurity of Jesus' early life, the Catechism states, quote, "During the greater part of his life, Jesus shared the condition of the vast majority of human beings, a daily life spent without evident greatness, a life of manual labor. His religious life was that of a Jew obedient to the law of God, a life in the community. From this whole period, it is revealed to us that Jesus was obedient to his parents, and that he increased in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man." That's in paragraph 531.
Such a great quote. I've always used that about Catholic education, that we're trying to help our students, like Jesus, grow in wisdom and maturity and grace before God and men and women. Ron, Nazareth is so familiar to anybody who has any connection with Jesus. Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, is over the inscription on the cross by Pontius Pilate. Tell us something about this very, very famous town of Nazareth.
Nazareth was so insignificant that it's not even mentioned in the Old Testament. And when Philip told Nathanael, "We have found him of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph," Nathanael answered, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" That's in John 1:44-46. Nazareth was a small town nestled among the hills of the province of Galilee. The Mediterranean Sea can be seen from hills to the west of the town, and the Sea of Galilee is only about 20 miles to the east. It was off the beaten path, for the trade and camel travel routes were miles away to the east or to the west. It was in this obscure town that God lived with a concealed identity for at least 28 years among his creatures. As a child, he played with other children and was taught religion by his father and mother and the local rabbi, that is, the local religion teacher at the synagogue. Joseph taught his trade of carpentry to Jesus as well. Now, there was a cosmopolitan city by the name of Sepphoris, located about 4 miles to the northwest of Nazareth. And it had a diverse historical and architectural legacy that included Assyrian, Hellenistic, Judean, Babylonian, and Roman influences. We looked at all these in some detail in our series on the Old Testament. And it once served as a center of Jewish religious and spiritual life in Galilee. In fact, there's a tradition that Mary's parents, Anna and Joachim, were natives of the city. Historians have speculated that Joseph would have found work in the city for his carpentry skills.
Okay, very attractive to many of us growing up were the legends that we heard about the miracles that Jesus performed when he was a child. I didn't really know till later that they were all legends. Can you tell us whether or not there is any truth in these stories?
Well, many stories have come down to us describing miracles performed by Jesus as a child. And he did perform many miracles during his public life, but I doubt that he performed any as a child, certainly not any visible to others. For example, one apocryphal story in the Gospel of Pseudo-Matthew states that the infant Jesus was said to have made Egyptian idols bow down before him. The Proto-Evangelium of James tells several stories in which a younger Jesus performs miracles, such as bringing a dead bird back to life. The infancy Gospel of Thomas is full of miracles allegedly performed by Jesus in his childhood. One of the episodes involves Jesus making clay birds, which he then proceeds to bring to life. In another, a child disperses water that Jesus had collected. Jesus then curses him, which causes the child's body to wither into a corpse.
That's a wild one.
Yes. Another child dies when Jesus curses him when he apparently accidentally bumps into him. In another story, he resurrects a friend who is killed when he falls from a roof, and he heals another who cuts his foot with an axe. In one story, new teachers try to teach him something, but he proceeds to explain the law to them instead. Then there is another set of miracles in which Jesus heals his brother, who is bitten by a snake, and two others who have died from different causes. Other miracles have him carrying water on cloth, producing a feast from a single grain, stretching a beam of wood to help his father finish constructing a bed, helping a man from snake poisoning or healing a man from snake poisoning, resurrecting a child who died of illness and resurrecting a man who died in a construction accident. Well, we know, of course, in Jesus during his public ministry, he healed the sick, even raised the dead to life out of compassion and to prove that he was God during his adulthood. But he wasn't a little show-off as a child. Jesus knew that he was at all times, knew who he was at all times during his life, and that he had the power to do anything he chose to do. However, his profound humility would have never permitted him to perform public miracles until he was ready to reveal his identity to his disciples.
So the legends are mostly legends, and they're certainly wild in many cases. Many thanks to our listening audience. May God bless you all, always, and in all ways.